Welcome to Federal News Network's Data and Application Security Series, brought to you by Four Incorporated. Here's today's moderator, Justin Doubleday.
Welcome and thanks for joining us. My guest today is the Senior Advisor for National Cybersecurity Policy and Programs at the Energy Department, Amy Hamilton. Amy, great to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me here, Justin.
Absolutely. And Amy, I know you're on detail over at the National Defense University. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing there right now.
Justin, I just have to say, I could not be any happier in my life right now. It has been the most incredible opportunity. I'm about a year and a half into a three-year detail to the College of Information and Cyberspace at the National Defense University. So I'm still a DOE employee. And periodically, I work, you know, with my DOE counterparts. I am able to look at different ways to synchronize efforts, as well as pretty much my full-time job is teaching, doing research, doing engagement. And what it's really allowed me to do as a DOE employee is to work on some of those really deep, wicked problems, like we're discussing today, that you just don't have time when you're in the mix. You know, when you're in an agency, you're very much in just survival mode every single day. You're just dealing with the latest threats that's coming out, the latest vulnerabilities that's coming out. And this has been a wonderful opportunity to focus on that, as well as now the Department of Energy. We are able to send students to the different Department of Defense College of Information and Cyberspace programs. So it's just been an excellent partnership between our two agencies and a real opportunity to dig into some of these wicked matters that we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. And, you know, it must be great to be able to bring Energy Department folks over to NDU. I mean, what are some of the things that you've been able to dive into at the university that maybe you wouldn't have had time to do if you were still full-time at Energy?
So one of the first projects I took over with me was working more on operational technology and zero trust. It's an area very, very close to the heart of the Department of Energy, as we're so involved with operational technology. There's actually an article that came out on one of our sister agencies, NASA, saying that NASA does not have enough security controls right now when it comes to spacecraft. FAA is on something similar. I'm actually working with some FAA team members right now on some of the zero trust vulnerabilities in their operational technology. So really getting that kind of operational technology, zero trust nexus that we had identified early on at DOE, saying this is important. But like I said, in that day-to-day cyber battle, if you will, when you are just looking at the latest KEVs, looking at everything coming out, you don't have that time to say, what is this kind of 3-year? What is this 5-year? And more importantly, when it came to zero trust and operational technology, how are you going to adjust what we've done traditionally in the Purdue model, protecting operational technology by segmenting it off? And micro-segmentation is going to be a huge piece of the future, but really looking at some of the things of how do you look at CIA, you know, confidentiality, integrity, availability, but also the big S in operational technology is safety. And that safety has to be more important than any of those things. If you add latency into the electric grid and you're no longer able to produce power, that is a very significant major detriment that you can't do. And so it's really looking at these factors, and we're working with many of the other agencies that are experiencing it. Another thing that I've been able to do is one of my students right now, really excited, as he is wrapping up his 1-year thesis project, he has done this on zero trust and looking specifically at one program involving the DIB. And really, how do we start looking at zero trust when it comes to our defense industrial base partners? So lots of great opportunities to kind of do that research that you always want to do and get deeper meaning, you know, when you're in that day-to-day agency battle where you just don't have the time.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating and such a great boon for both you and your career, I'm sure, and also for the Energy Department to have you over there looking at some of these really important issues and bringing that back to them. And I know you were the DOE PMO lead for Zero Trust. Just tell us a little bit about, you know, how agencies should be approaching this issue. You know, here in 2024, it's not a new conversation anymore. The Zero Trust strategy has been out for 2 years. Where do you think we're at right now, and where are we going?
Justin, it's pretty incredible when you think about it. It was May 21st, 3 years ago when Executive Order 14028 came out and said, okay, departments, in 60 days, you need to have a zero trust strategy. And at this time, the entire federal government was somewhat sent scrambling. What is zero trust? What should we be doing in zero trust? And now everyone is talking about this. We have this common lexicon. The CISA zero trust model has come out. The M229 has come out telling agencies what to do. So really just an incredible amount of work went into the initial guidelines. One of the things I'm very, very proud about the Department of Energy is when we did our zero trust strategy in that 60-day sprint almost 3 years ago, when we looked at that, one of the things we said is we have to invest in people. We have to invest in our workforce. And our CIO, Ann Duncan, just tremendous effort, really listened to us. And we always talk about the people and the processes and the technology, but we don't put the people first, right? That doesn't seem to be the case. And in this case, we really did. And one of the things we identified is a need to train the workforce on zero trust. And we put forward an initiative to ensure that at every single site within Department of Energy, so it's 91 sites, that we have at least one person trained on zero trust at each site at a minimum, and really investing in that workforce and showing people like we are putting the effort into you. And when people become nervous, they're like, okay, jobs are important and they don't want to work themselves out of a job. So how much better to train them in advance and give them that security that, hey, you know what? Your job might shift. You know, we no longer need wheelwrights. I don't even know where to find a real wheelwright anymore, right? So, you know, on the end, you're going to go to Firestone and you're going to get a tire, right? So it is okay. There's going to be an evolution. There's going to be an involvement, and include that workforce early so that they're not afraid. And I think that by doing that at DOE, and then, for instance, the move, Anne has been really tremendous about allowing details and encouraging the interaction across the departments, because she really recognizes that we're one federal government. She used to be the CIO over at EPA and just really maintained those strong ties with her former agency, as well as with the federal CIO and special counsels.
Got it. That's a great overview. I mean, yeah, I think we can definitely talk about workforce throughout this conversation. But one of the things we are exploring during this series is kind of gaining more visibility into your data and applications within a zero trust architecture, understanding how your data is moving. Are your applications secure? Are your APIs secure? I mean, what do you see as some of the key components to gaining that visibility within a zero trust architecture, and some of the main challenges given where a lot of federal agencies are today and just modernizing a lot of their applications too?
So one of the things I think is super interesting is the Department of Defense, where I'm detailed to right now, they define cyberspace as looking at the entire information environment. And I think a lot of times when civilian agencies and civilian organizations look at cyber, they're only looking at the security aspect. But if you look at this whole concept of cyberspace, it's everything. So the modernization is part of making things more secure. And data is the entire reason why networks exist. I used to love, back in the day, I was talking yesterday with someone about coding in BASIC, right? And, you know, kids don't need to learn how to code in BASIC anymore. And that was something that, you know, we did in junior high school. And when I look at that, you know, I really look at the fact that it used to be fun to work on networks where it's just a whole bunch of geeks hanging out and doing code for the sake of doing code to see what they could experiment on. But now networks are there, applications are there to make sure that users have the ability to do something. And it's very, very important that we continue to recognize that. Data has been assessed maturity-wise as the weakest pillar across the federal government. And when you look at our adversarial capabilities, intellectual property theft has been unprecedented, that the Five Eyes intelligence agencies got together and made an announcement saying that those adversaries who are stealing our intellectual property are on notice. This is completely unprecedented. And right now, when you look at our race to quantum encryption, this is sort of the new race to the moon. If you'll look back in history, when Sputnik was launched by the Russians, this really galvanized the United States that we had to go ahead and win that race to the moon. We very quickly were able to launch our first satellite, which was the second satellite, into orbit. And then eventually we were able to launch our first moon mission. And when you look at quantum, it's very disconcerting, because whoever is able to break quantum first all the data that you have that's encrypted right now, they should be able to crack that then and decrypt it. So it's just so important that we move into that direction and that we constantly recognize the importance of the data and working with the operations teams. One of the things I've really seen change in the past 3 years is working with both procurement and operations. And this has been very, very game-changing with people understanding that cyberspace operations, the ability to do business electronically, has just fundamentally changed. It's not just nice to have, it's an absolutely must have now.
Again, that's Amy Hamilton, Senior Advisor for National Cybersecurity Policy and Programs at the Energy Department. We're going to take a short break, but we'll pick up the conversation when we come back.
Securing your agency's data is paramount. IBM API Connect, integrated with Noname Security, offers a tailored solution for federal agencies. Protecting sensitive data isn't just about safeguarding. It's about ensuring availability, recovery, and reliability to support mission-critical operations. As an IBM Platinum partner, 4Inc trusts IBM API Connect, integrated with Noname Security, for unmatched speed and efficiency in securing, accessing, and ensuring the integrity of vital data. Visit FOURINC.com.
Welcome back to the Data and Application Security series sponsored by 4Inc. I'm your moderator, Justin Doubleday, and I'm speaking with the Energy Department's Senior Advisor for National Cybersecurity Policy and Programs, Amy Hamilton. Amy, the complexity of an agency's IT enterprise is increasing with more applications, more data, more interconnections. And complexity can lead to security gaps. So how should agencies be approaching that issue as they modernize?
I really think that we have to look at cyberspace holistically. And what I will say is people sometimes forget the impetus and the history of cyberspace. And so when you look at it, it was really a whole bunch of nerds who wanted to share information between different laboratories and different universities. And it was built to be completely transparent, completely open. It was not built with security in mind. That was not part of the concept. And if you look at where we've built it now, it's very, very interesting. There's no other place, if you think about the virtual world, you're in one application, you go in and you do your personal banking on your personal computer. Then you go into another application and you're gaming, and you can literally be anything, do anything in these games. And you can be a completely different persona. And then you go into your social media persona. So when you look at it, it's a very interesting space to be. I mean, there's no building that you could physically go into that has all these things. And we have not in any way explored virtual security the way we have physical security and the physical means of doing things. A lot of times people try to compare the virtual space to when we had first had the airspace, right? And they're like, oh, you know, it's the same. We can start doing these things. And I always ask in forums, I'm like, well, who has their own airplane? And I'm like, first of all, because I want to know you. But second of all, let's compare this. Right now, the last statistics came out that there's 8.7 devices. And this is not counting IoT and OT. This is just human interface devices. 8.7 for every human in the United States. There is less than 0.05% for airplanes. So you cannot in any way scale that. And a lot of times people are saying, well, the average citizen shouldn't have to know cybersecurity. And I want to argue that point. Instead, I want to say they do, but they need to know the same basics as you do. You know to lock your house. You know that you need to have fire extinguishers. You know that you need to have smoke detectors, carbon monoxide protectors. When you're a little kid in school, they teach you stop, drop, and roll in case there's a fire. And they teach you to go into the basement when there's going to be a tornado. This is part of learning the hazards of surviving in the physical world. And we really need to do the same things in the virtual world and recognize it is going to be hard and it is going to be complicated because we've built an entire digital ecosystem and a digital world And now we're trying to put things into play. And if you look at how long it's taken us to figure this out in physical space, it's taken a very long time. A few, you know, what is it? Almost 4,000 years now. And we still don't have it right. So we still have a long place to go in the virtual world, but we can certainly model it after what we've done in physical space.
And for federal CISOs and CIOs who are looking at this big problem, and at the same time, a lot of these applications, they want to move things into the cloud. And now that brings in an additional change in terms of your environment is no longer on-prem. It's in the cloud. It's somewhere else. I mean, what are some best practices in your view for securely moving workloads and operating workloads in the cloud under a zero trust strategy?
I think that there is a underutilized resource out there that you can get on cio.gov, and this is the application rationalization playbook. And if people out there have not taken a look at it, I strongly suggest you take a look at that. If you look at the statistics right now, when you look at the adversarial side, which is super scary, is there was a 400% increase in API attacks in 2022. And that's according to Salt Security. So that's a really big increase. But it really goes back into what you've mentioned a few times. We have to do the basics well. You need to go back to your basic PM methodology. You need to make sure that you're looking at what makes sense for you, what makes sense for your programs. Because if you're not doing those things well, then you are going to fail. You need to understand, when you look at the application rationalization playbook, which I cannot say three times fast, they have a very simple six-step process. And it's identifying your needs, inventorying your applications, assessing the value, assessing the TCO. And a lot of times we do not do that. We do not look at total cost of ownership. If it's in-prem, we should just move it to the cloud. Really, that goes back into working on those first four steps with the business owners, making sure that it makes sense. When that part's done, scoring the applications and then determining the placement. A lot of it too involves whether you like it or hate it. And I know I get a lot of feedback from industry, but FedRAMP, believe it or not, is a pretty successful program when you look at the federal government coming together and working for commons in one direction. So no, FedRAMP is not perfect, but it's certainly much better than a lot of other things that we've done. So really making sure that we're working with that FedRAMP program, that when an agency is interested in cloud technology that hasn't gone through the FedRAMP process yet, you know, that agency being a sponsor and getting something into FedRAMP and working with these different partners, because it's so important that we are looking at the security risks. And a lot of times vendors will ask me, why is it that even though something is FedRAMP, an agency is going to look at it different? And I think it goes back into that physical space analogy. You know, if you're looking at a fire sprinkler system, that not every building has the same fire suppression system. You have to make sure that based on the risks of your building, you're doing the right things and putting in the right controls, and is the same in cybersecurity. So like you said, doing that good due diligence, going back to the PM methodologies, going back to those basics.
You know, you mentioned that scary statistic, a 400% increase in API attacks. You've also talked about how you're looking at operational technology and how that's becoming obviously more of a concern across multiple agencies and in industry. I mean, when you talk to, you know, other federal IT folks, you know, federal CISOs, what's your sense of, what are some of their greatest concerns right now and biggest challenges?
Well, I think the biggest challenge that we have right now is what we had in the past, but it's accelerated, and that's the shiny object. And when you look at historically, you know, something would come into the market and then we'd start looking at how do we bring this into play. When you look at ChatGPT, that hit and launched on the last day of November, 2022. A year and a half later, it is so incredibly mainstream. The use of generative AI, the fact that there's already an executive order on how we should be addressing AI, that there's an OMB memo on what to do about AI. The technology, the speed from technology to hit the market and be adopted is so fast now. And for the CISOs out there, it's just overwhelming. How do you secure everything? And if you are even looking forward and you look at like what happened recently with Elon Musk and the whole Neuralink. How do you secure someone's brain when literally there's a chip in someone's brain? And if you look at the future of technology, it only becomes harder. And this really, I want to tie this back into what you said about the whole, you know, DevSecOps. And I always want to put the sec first, by the way, because I think we do have to move into a model of security first. And we have to look at it, like I said, working with the procurement teams, looking at it from the very inception of the supply chain, making sure that we're doing the cyber-informed secure engineering right from the beginning. DOE did a paper on that a couple years ago, and just cyber-informed engineering has to be the way to go. We used to just let the engineers have a wonderful time and then we'd bring the security people in. But it has to be part of how we're designing systems in order for these systems to be secure so that once they're hitting the market, once they're coming in and being adopted, we're not having to worry about security afterwards. And I know a lot of people talk about the whole baked in and not bolted on, but I think it's even more than that. I think it's really looking at it all the way holistically to who are the suppliers, who are the producers, what are the supply chain risks, and making sure that we're addressing this with that 20, 30 year life cycle. At the same time, recognizing on the other hand that something's going to come out tomorrow and the CIO and the user is going to want to implement it the next day. And so how do you bring all those things together? So I think it's an incredibly difficult time to be a CISO, and not just for the federal agencies, but after the recent SEC ruling that came out about private sector CISOs, the responsibility and onus on the CISOs is unprecedented, you know, when it comes to looking at a C-suite level position. And a lot of times the CISOs are hamstrung because they have all of the responsibility, none of the authority, and they can easily be overruled because it's a determination that is more important to be able to use it than for it to be secure. And if you look at the number of attacks that we're getting, you can definitely see that being reflected. And the other thing I'll say is we might be vulnerable, but everybody else is too, right? There is definitely that certain sense of, if you look at kind of Cold War mentality, it doesn't make sense for one person to do an action because they know the others can do an action that can be equally detrimental. So I think there is a certain point of recognizing that we have a lot of global vulnerabilities right now, and we do have an opportunity to work together and to move in that direction. And we started off with zero trust, and I just think it's so important that we recognize there is no perimeter anymore. That's why we went away from that net-centric approach. And it's really looking at, you have to secure the application, you have to encrypt the data, you have to recognize device identity, you have to recognize human identity and persona identity. There was a lot of discussions the other day at an AI conference on, you know, how are we going to address, you know, AI identity? And so there's so many different facets of this to look at. And I think just constantly realizing it will evolve. There is no endpoint. When people always ask, like, when are you done with your cybersecurity program? The answer is never, right? We're not going to stop evolving technology and using technology. So we can't stop securing technology. It's just a continuous growth process that everybody needs to embrace.
All right. Well, I think that's a fantastic way to end it. So again, Amy Hamilton, she's Senior Advisor for National Cybersecurity Policy and Programs at the Energy Department, also on detail over at the National Defense University College of Information and Cyberspace as the Energy Department's visiting faculty member. Thank you, Amy, so much for your insights.
Thank you, Justin.
And again, I'm your moderator, Justin Doubleday, on the Data and Application Security Series. To learn more, go to federalnewsnetwork.com and search for Inc.
Thank you for listening to Federal News Network's Data and Application Security Series, brought to you by 4 Incorporated.